Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
In my life, there have been so many great races, so it's hard to pick one. But a good race is when you don't think you have a chance of winning. So, a very spectacular race was the one at the Nürburgring in 1957. Nürburgring was one of my favourite circuits because the driver always had a chance. It's a circuit of 23 kilometres with 166 turns and ups and downs. If you got there with less, you could always do a lot. It's one of the circuits I liked most to race on. Those are the words of the late Juan Manuel Fangio describing his final F1 win, the 1957 German Grand Prix, which took place at the Nürburgring, and he picked as his race of my life to Autosport in 1989. This pick, which is often cited as one of Fangio's finest F1 triumphs, a legendary race in the championship's history, in a career of much success, is the latest of our Race of My Life mini-series. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and with me today are two guests, and the first is one of the UK's leading commentators, Ian Titchmarsh, whose racing career goes back to the 1950s. Ian, how are you, and welcome to the Race of My Life podcast.
I'm pretty good, but feeling old in view of what you've just said, Alex. Yes, looking forward to this, to talk about Fangio and Tony Brooks.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we'll get to the race in detail in a second, but first I must introduce my second guest, which is a Race of My Life podcast regular, Autosport's chief editor, Kevin Turner. How are you, Kev?
Yeah, pretty good. Yeah, like Ian, I'm looking forward to this one as well. That's a bit further back than some of our recent Race of My Life. So, I love motorsport history. So, yeah, ready to go on it.
Absolutely. Well, I think this is a good one to get you both on, and it's a very, very interesting race, and for so long, you know, perhaps even still considered the best race in Formula One's history, because as we will come to see, what a legendary drive it was from Fangio that day. So a little bit of background to the race. First of all, Fangio arrived at the Nürburgring. He was leading the standings after wins at home in Argentina, in Monaco, and the French Grand Prix at Rouen that year in 1957. He qualified on pole, but as we will come to see, it was the preparation for the race that made what happened pretty key. So Ian, can you describe a bit the day? What happened? What was the sort of the key things of the race, really? Sort of just ahead of the action starting, and then what Fangio had seen in his practice running, things like that.
I'm going to go back to a race we'll be talking about later on when it comes to me. But the previous race had been Aintree, the European Grand Prix at Aintree, and it was the only time I ever saw Fangio race. And he really was having an off day. He tootled around in something like fifth place before retiring. So the great Fangio, having had a dismal day at Aintree, then goes off to the Nürburgring and has what was probably, yes, I mean, he chose it as the race of his life. It was a quite remarkable performance. There were other races that had taken place or were going to take place in the World Championship at Pescara and Monza, where again he was beaten by Stirling Moss, who had beaten him at Aintree with Tony Brooks' help. And it was, I suppose, the last great race of a number of great races that he had, the culmination of his career at the age of 46.
So, yeah, Kev, what can you tell us about the sort of the background to the race when Fangio arrived? What had happened in the practice sessions?
Well, essentially, they'd realised that they couldn't, that there would be a struggle to get through the race on one set of tyres. They were fairly convinced that Ferrari would be able to go through on the one set, but they didn't feel they could go through on the Pirellis on the Maserati. So they practiced pit stops, changing the tyres, which in those days wasn't a 2-3 second job like it is now. And they took the decision also to start on half tanks or less fuel. So people think that Brabham invented that in the 1980s, but it happened before then. And so the idea was that Fangio would go off in the lead on his lighter fuel, come in, change tyres, and the practice times that the mechanics had been doing suggested that he would be able to get out still in the lead, or at least pretty close to it. So that was the game plan going in. The thing that set up the great drive really was the pit stop, for reasons that I don't think Fangio was ever entirely clear on. The pit stop was disastrous. It took about twice as long as they'd done in practice. I guess maybe the pressure of the moment. And that meant that Peter Collins and Mike Hawthorn in the Ferraris were quite some way down the road by the time Fangio came out the pits.
Yeah, a point about this half fuel tank start. It wasn't the first time it had been done by Maserati. Kevin, you'll remember that in the 1953 French Grand Prix, Maserati started Gonzalez on half tanks. And he almost caught Fangio and Mike Hawthorne at the finish of that race. That was the race that Mike Hawthorne won in the Ferrari, with Fangio coming up alongside him in the Maserati, but coming up fast behind the pair of them, having done what came to be known as the Fangio-type half-tank race, was Gonzalez.
That's right, I'd forgotten about that, yeah.
So that's when it was a Maserati tactic, if you like, which they'd done before. Now, the pit stop, as you say, going back to Fangio and the Nürburgring, the pit stop, I think, took something like 50 seconds. It took almost twice as long as the original pit stop plan was. And so he had a huge amount of ground to make up, and he was taking tens of seconds off Mike Hawthorne and Peter Collins, who, according to the way you read the reports at the time, it gives the impression that Peter Collins and Mike Hawthorne were playing around by that stage. They thought, oh, well, Fangio's not going to catch us now. He's had to make this pit stop and he's way back. So we're going to, it's just a question of deciding which one of us is going to win this race. And then suddenly they realised that from the pit signals, and of course, at the Nürburgring in those days, you went down to the south turn, came back up behind the pits. And so it was possible to give a pit signal to the drivers as they settled on the next lap. But of course, the next lap was 14 miles, so they didn't get any more information about what they were doing relative to the other contenders for another 7 or 8 minutes.
And I think that I recently read Fangio's autobiography, My 20 Years of Racing, which I'd recommend to people. Actually, it's a good read. But one of the things I like about it in there is that he and his team, they essentially agree that he won't go flat chat on his first lap or two out the pits. So the first couple of laps after the tyre change aren't particularly stellar anyway, and that helps to lull Ferrari into a full sense of security that Fangio isn't really a threat. They show the sort of easy board to Collins and Hawthorne as well, because in those days cars did break often. So if you could get away with not flogging it, then you would. And of course, as Ian says, it's a very long lap. So after a couple of laps of not being quite so on it and letting the lead not really change, Fangio then puts the hammer down. And of course, it's effectively a 9-10 minute lap. And I'm sure that Ferrari wouldn't have been able to get the signs out straight away after the south curve on the first time round. So it was probably another lap or two before they could even get the Collins Hawthorne hurry up. By which time, Fangio is driving, just on a different level, really smashing the lap record. He talks about taking certain corners with a gear higher to carry momentum through, taking risks around the Nürburgring that I think were very rare. Drivers wouldn't have been flat chat around the Nürburgring of the whole race. But I think that he picked it out because it was a race where he was just absolutely driving as fast as he could to make up the lost ground.
But not, of course, but taking up your point about how for a couple of laps after his pit stop, he wasn't going flat out. So he didn't drive flat out actually the whole race. The majority of the race, yes. And I might deviate here to talk about other great races at the Nürburgring, which, because it's a great circuit, delivered some fantastic races by some of the greatest drivers. There was Nuvolari in 1935 when he beat the Mercedes in the Auto Union with the Alfa Romeo. And that was another one of the all-time great races on the Nürburgring. And, of course, still to come was Stirling Moss dirty in the Aston Martin in 1959 and 58 and 59 and in 1961 in the German Grand Prix. So the Nürburgring has probably delivered more great races from great drivers than any other circuit, Kevin, discussed.
No, I would agree with that. I think when I put my top 10 races together for the various drivers, any great driver prior to 1977, so the last German Grand Prix at Nürburgring in 1976, the old Nürburgring, that is, of course, pretty much all the greats have at least one sort of super performance there. Jackie Stewart, obviously, in the rain in 1968 would be another one. Jackie Ickx had a couple of big drives there as well. John Surtees picked the 1963 German Grand Prix as the race of his life.
As we discussed on the podcast for John Surtees, he did indeed, didn't he?
Indeed. And I always, when I'm having to put the races in order, obviously one of the major factors is what the drivers themselves say about it. but also it's what the track is, you know, which venue are they at. And I must admit, I do tend to give extra weighting to the Nürburgring, because I think pretty much anyone that raced there agrees that it's the greatest racetrack in the world.
I mean, I think you have to. It's just that legendary track, isn't it? It's so much more difficult than anything we see nowadays. And even back then, it was an outlier, wasn't it, in terms of how tough it was for the drivers?
Yeah, although, as we'll probably get on to shortly, there were some absolutely epic events that, well, first of all, that were still happening in the 1950s, but going further back in Fangio's own career, some of the races he did in South America were just mind-boggling through today's eyes.
Before he came to Europe and became a, if you like, a Europeanized Formula One driver, the Race of the North, or whatever it is, that he won in 1940. There were some extraordinary races there. But one of the South American Grand Prix for Mercedes, when he drove without a relief in the 1955 Argentinian Grand Prix in enormous heat, and every other driver had to change to another driver. It was a three-hour race in incredible heat. And Fangio, at the age of whatever he would have been then, 45, 44, 45, saw them all off, won the race. It was impossibly hot that day.
That's on my list of races, alternative races for Fangio, which I'm sure we'll get onto in a minute with Alex as well. But yeah, I'd agree that's in the mix.
We will, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing two experts and fans getting into what other races Fangio could have picked. But just very briefly on taking back to what Fangio writes in his Race of My Life, or what he said for the Race of My Life feature. He says, "So I had to risk. That's something I never did before in my life." And I wanted to ask you both, does he mean at the Nürburgring, or does he mean he just never risked like that in any other race?
I have a stab at the answer to that question, Alex. He did take other risks, and one of them ended up in a big accident. He had to drive overnight from having tried to drive the BRM, the V16 BRM, in the Ulster Trophy, to get to Monza to take part in, I don't think it was the Monza Grand Prix. It wasn't the Italian Grand Prix at Monza.
That's right.
And he'd driven virtually non-stop through the night and got there in time to start the race. But he crashed quite heavily and hurt himself quite badly. In fact, that's probably the worst accident he ever had in his career. And so that was, if you like, risk-taking. And he was well aware he was risk-taking in driving flat out across Europe to get to Monza. In terms of actual driving, I mean, I don't suppose he regarded it as a risk. In for example, the 1953 millimetre, I think I might be saying it was, wasn't it, the Alfa Romeo, when the front steering broke on one side of the car, so he only had one wheel steering for a significant part of the last part of the race, and that's millimetre Italian ordinary roads. So that was a risk, but he probably not regard that as a risk in the same way as the German Grand Prix was.
With modern eyes, all of these events seem incredibly risky and dangerous, but I think the top drivers, sort of, especially of those that era, the real top guys, I think had a something in hand, or they knew what they could push and when they could push. Fangio actually talks about in his autobiography. He talks about that 1940 International Grand Prix of the North that Ian mentioned earlier, which is his first big win, really, that makes him the sort of breakout talent in Argentina or in South America. And he said prior to that, he remembers driving flat out. This is a huge road race that makes the Mio Emilia look like a sprint, basically. I guess the closest thing now would be a sort of a desert raid Dakar type thing, really. But and he broke the car, and in 1940 he got himself into a battle. But then I think his leading competitor had a problem, and he then sort of drove to win rather than to drive flat out. And that's perhaps that's the start of Fangio's "you drive at the slowest possible speed to win" type mantra. So that you weren't, and partly it was risking, but also it was to look after the machinery, because, say, cars broke, with the possible exception of the Mercedes when he was driving in 1954-55, cars broke a lot. So to flog them for 3-4 hours or more was not really a very good idea, and I think Fangio understood that very well.
When you say cars broke, you said Mercedes. Well, I think the Alfa Romeo was a pretty durable car as well. They didn't break on him that often. For example, when he retired from the 1950, the first World Championship race, the 1950 European Grand Prix at Silverstone, that was his own doing. He'd gone off and damaged the radiator. That's why he ultimately had to retire from that race. when he could have won it. He was having a big battle with Farina in the other Alfa. So the Alfas were very durable cars as well, as much as the Mercedes.
I think that's fair, although Fangio was pretty frustrated by some of his problems that he had during 1950. He's certainly more complimentary about the Mercedes than the Alfa. But then, to be fair to Alfa, you know, Mercedes would have had an awful lot more resources at its disposal.
Was he a Mercedes dealer?
I think it's an honestly held opinion. Whether you agree with that or not, of course, is another matter. But I know that you are an Alfa Romeo fan, Ian, so maybe the truth lies somewhere in between.
Well, whatever it is, we don't even speculate. But what remains a mystery to me, as I say, it was the only time I saw him race was the 57 European Grand Prix at Aintree. What an off day he had there. By his own admission, I mean, the reports at the time said that he was, and I remember watching him and thinking, this is the great Fangio. Obviously, all the focus was on, we'll come to this later on, the Stirling Moss in the Van Wall in that race, and he was totally eclipsed. And then he comes back a couple of weeks later and produces this amazing drive at the Nürburgring.
Absolutely, and we've discussed the pit stop and the charge that Fangio makes, but how is it that he gets by Hawthorn and Collins?
They weren't able to respond. I mean, Fangio had got himself at a peak of performance in that race that they just couldn't match. I mean, whatever debate one can have about how good was Mike Hawthorn, how good was Peter Collins by comparison with Fangio, he was just irresistible. And I think the relative performance, I mean, certainly that was the case at Aintree, between the Ferrari, which was basically the D50 Lancia made into the Ferrari for 1957, and the Maserati 250F, was pretty similar. I mean, at Aintree, the early parts of the race had been led by Jean Behra in the 250F Maserati from Mike Hawthorn in the Ferrari. So the pause of the cars wasn't... But Fangio was just an irresistible force that day in Germany.
I, to give you some idea, I think there's actually a bit of footage of him going inside Collins into the left-hander at the south on the south curve, I think. That's where he takes second. He gets Hawthorn... So this is a 22-lap race, which at the Nürburgring was 3.5 hours. And so he catches them on lap 21, so the penultimate lap, and passes them both. And I think that what you see then is Hawthorn actually drives very hard to hold on to him, and he's only 3.6 seconds behind at the end, whereas Collins is more than half a minute back.
I think Dennis Jenkins' report of that race, got sort of slight tongue-in-cheek, suggests that Mike Hawthorn, once he'd been overtaken by Fangio, was determined not to let him get away, and so that kind of woke Mike Hawthorn up, and he was able to respond, because on his day, Hawthorn was a great driver. Peter Collins, as you just said, Kevin, he wasn't able to respond in the way that Mike Hawthorn did.
I think the only criticism you would have of the race is when you bring in the opposition, because Van Wall were all at sea with their suspension settings, so Moss and Brooks were not factored in the race. Moss finished fifth, but he was 4.5 minutes behind. The Ferrari, from what I can see, Ferrari spent 2 years making the Lancia D50 worse. So I'm not convinced that they were particularly fantastic. It didn't win a single race in 57, did it? Perhaps to be fair about it, they didn't win a single world championship race in 57. It was all Maserati and Van Wall. And as you say, you know, where you would rate Hawthorn and Collins compared to Fangio. So I think it was the conditions were ripe for a situation like that. But obviously Fangio rose to the occasion. The fact that he said that it was the best drive where he took the most risks has got to be factored in massively.
Yeah. A factor that Enzo Ferrari used to say about Fangio, of course, Fangio didn't drive for Ferrari that much, just the 1956 season, was he always had the best cars in his career. You could discuss that and suggest that he had, because you just made the point that Van Wall was all at sea at the Nürburgring. It wasn't the perfect car by any means. Yes, it had won at Aintree and it went on to win at Pescara. So they got the Van Wall sorted quite quickly for another really challenging circuit at Pescara. But Fangio, year after year, always had the best car.
Yeah, he's sort of done a reverse Alonso in that he was always able to pick the right team to be in for the next season. I guess when he was with Maserati in 52, 53, I think it's probably fair to say that the Ferrari was the car to have. But yeah, after that, I mean, I think probably picking Mercedes wasn't a stroke of genius, because it was pretty obvious from what they'd done pre-war that they were going to. I think everyone was concerned about what they would do. So he then joined Ferrari for 56 and then Maserati for 57. So he was probably, more often than not, he was in the right kit. That's fair. And of course, the Alpha was the, until Ferrari with the 375 got it fully sussed, the Alpha 158, 159 was the car to have before. So yeah, he certainly did. But then when you're talking about the great drivers, they do normally find themselves into the best cars, because the top teams want the top drivers. So, but yeah.
Yeah, the one exception to that is Stirling Moss, sometimes, some years.
Yes, for the first part of his career, and then the last part. I think the bit in the middle was from Mercedes, Maserati and Van Wall was pretty good. But yeah, but either side, he was definitely fighting inferiority.
Well, if we go back to the 1957 German Grand Prix, so Fangio now in the lead. He does have a little bit of trouble before the end, where he mentions that the screws in the back of his seat broke, so he's gripping the wheel really hard just to keep going. But he does take victory, and with it, he clinches his fifth and final Formula One world title with two races of that season to go. So I think we'll just end this part of the podcast here, just with going back to some more words from Fangio, and then we'll get into what I imagine will be a great chat about what other races you guys think he could have picked. So Fangio says, "For me, this was the most emotional race. I was named Meister. If you win three times at the Nürburgring, then you are something special. And this race helped to give me the fifth world championship. When I was waiting for my laurels, I was very emotional. In 1954, a driver I took there to race had died at Saint-Onfray Marimont. So this circuit had given me happiness and sadness. Simply, now I can say it, I never thought I could win this race. I risked for the first time in my life." So there we have Fangio's thoughts on the 1957 German Grand Prix. That's why he picked it for his race of my life in autosport. But as we've established, he had so many tremendous drives. Ian, why don't we start with you? What alternatives could he have chosen? What really stands out to you as a great drive for Fangio?
Well, I think we've touched on it already, which I think has to be the 1955 Argentinian Grand Prix. I mean, as a feat of endurance, it was, I think, phenomenal. None of us have ever sat in a Formula One car, let alone sat in a Formula One car in incredibly hot conditions for 3 hours non-stop. That is a testament to his both ability and his fitness, even though you look at Fangio, photographs of Fangio now, and he's a little tubby chap. But he was very, very fit for driving in races of that sort. And that, for me, is one of his great races. You tend to have to look at the single-seater races and not the sports car races, where there's some others. They've done great drives in sports cars. But Fangio really was essentially a single-seater driver and a Grand Prix driver from the time he arrived in Europe.
Yeah, the only non-single-seater drives that I've had on my list to mention were the 1953 Mille Miglia that Ian mentioned earlier, finishing second in the Alpha with one wheel steering or with one, you know, not working properly, and then that 1940 International Grand Prix of the North, which was in his own self-built Chevy, which must have been a pretty amazing event. A totally different kind of event, important in a different way because, as I said earlier, about launching his career. But yeah, I think by and large, you're looking at single-seater racing. He didn't enjoy sports cars as much. There's very little reference to the sports car races in his autobiography, actually. Occasional, but he's very much focused on single-seaters. And actually, it's interesting because in some elements of the press, the arrival of the World Championship in 1950 was not really a big deal. But Fangio says he was very excited when he heard about it, and that it would be, he wanted to. He was coming from a background of a South American, reading about all these European stars. He'd gone over there and he'd obviously built confidence. He'd done better. Top drivers had given him encouragement. And it became a sort of a challenge to go and race for Argentina and beat the world's best. And so the title of world champion, I think, meant more to him than perhaps some other people at the time. So he was probably looking at the points a lot earlier than you know, it's hard to imagine now because obviously we're all obsessed with points and championships, but I don't think everyone was in those days. But I think Fangio was quite keen on it from the very start.
Can I just pick up on that point you make about the interest in the world championship? I think I'm right in saying I haven't got a copy to hand, but I'm pretty sure that the race programme for the first Grand Prix, the European Grand Prix, the first World Championship race at Silverstone in May 1950, didn't mention the World Drivers' Championship at all. And certainly, I've got a copy of that, picked it up recently online, of the motor, because there was no autosport, perish the thought, no autosports at that time. It was coming out in a few months' time. So the race report in the motor by Grand Vitesse, Rodney Walkerley, does not mention the World Championship at all. There's no reference to the fact that it was the first round of this new championship for drivers. And I'm pretty sure the race program didn't mention it either. So it was no big deal. It really wasn't. But you're probably right, Kevin, to say that it meant more to Fangio. As the season went on, a little bit more interest picked up. But I haven't actually checked it from Autosport. But by the time you get to the first Autosport coming out August 1950, there may have been some reference to the World Championship, but not very much. It was not a big deal.
No, I think it was seen in its early days as a kind of a bit of an Italian benefit, wasn't it? Because, you know, it was going to be the driver of an Italian car that was going to win it, whether it be probably an Alfa, but, you know, there were also Ferrari and Maserati around as well. So I think a lot of people were a bit cynical about it as being a way of giving some more laurels to Italian motorsport, which is perhaps why some of the British press tended to ignore it a bit. But Fangio had an Italian family background. Italian immigrants, he'd been to, you know, Italy at that time was kind of the centre of motor racing, and he was, I think, awestruck when he was there, and he obviously enjoyed being there. So he was probably coming from more that culture where the World Championship was more of a thing. But if I may pitch in to the other, interestingly, there was a book in Adrian Ball, I don't know where you got it in, edited in the early 70s for the Jim Clark Foundation, which he asked about 20 drivers for their Race of My Life. So a precursor, if you like, to the Autosport series. And Fangio in that one picks the 1953 Italian Grand Prix, which is an interesting choice because in subsequent interviews, I think he always said 57 Germany. So in that race, that was when the World Championship was run to Formula 2 regulations. Fangio missed most of 1952, as Ian said earlier, because of his big crash at Monza. And this was towards the end of the season. NASCAR had won everything for 2 years, basically. And this is long before the word chicane has appeared at Monza. So it's a flat-out blast. And it's two Ferraris, Farina and Ascari, and the two Maseratis initially of Fangio and Marimon, who was the son of one of Fangio's former rivals that he was sort of looking after in Europe, protege, if you like. And the four of them put on a slipstreaming battle, which went on. I think Marimon has a problem, so drops out and then joins the pack again a few laps down. And the four of them are heading into, I think it all kicks off at Parabolica, doesn't it? And I've read a few different accounts of what happens at the last corner, the last lap. What's your...
I'm not sure if it's called Parabolica then, but it's the same corner we're talking about. It was there with a couple of laps to go, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was on the final lap. It's quite interesting to read slightly different accounts on what happened. Some blame a backmarker, some blame oil, but essentially Ascari goes into a spin. Farina has to take avoiding action. Marimon, I think, hits the Ferrari. And Fangio, who did seem to have a knack of finding a gap when there was an incident happening, he was had almost like a sixth sense. It comes up a few times in his career that he just manages to be in the right place at the right time, slips through and wins the race. So he himself says it was a fortunate victory, but it was also one of his great ones, A, because it had been such a titanic fight for the entire race in a way that normally when you're looking for great races in the 50s, one or other of the top runners has a mechanical problem and it doesn't last to the end. But this one did right to the very end. He won it, and of course it was quite a big deal for him because it was sort of banishing the demons of the crash that he had the year before, which I suspect probably explains why he put it forward as one of his best.
Now, that kind of leads into, you're talking about his ability to be in the right place at the right time, of course, the Le Mans race in 1955, when he managed to avoid getting caught up in the accident involving Pierre Levesque and Lance Macklin's Austin Healey. And the car went to the crowd and all the people were killed. He managed to steer through that. And that had been the end of what had been a fantastic battle between him and Mike Hawthorn in the D-Type Jaguar, which had gone on for about 2 hours in the opening stages of the race. And that was probably, see what Kevin thinks about this, probably his best sports car drive. I know he cited another one, but I would have thought the 53 millimeter. I would have thought that battle with Hawthorn, which was a kind of rerun of their battle in the French Grand Prix 2 years earlier.
Yeah, I think it's probably up there, isn't it? He, because of the nature of the disaster, he doesn't really want to talk much about the fight with Hawthorn. Although it's very clear from his account of the 53 French Grand Prix that he rates Hawthorn and respects him as a competitor. And yeah, they went had it hammer and tongs in their first couple of hours, to the point where I think that some of the reporters described it as effectively a Grand Prix type fight. But yeah, he does talk about the incident because he says he's sort of forever thankful, perhaps the wrong word, but remembers that Pierre Levay managed to throw his arm up to indicate that he was going left in the last fraction of a second, which indicated to Fangio that he should go right. Well, that was Fangio's interpretation of the signal anyway. And unfortunately, of course, Levay chose incorrectly, effectively, because Matt Clinsheely is going towards the left and it acts as a launch pad for the 300 SLR and going into the crowd and all that horrible stuff. But Fangio then talks about he's missed that incident to the left, but he's then confronted by Hawthorn's slowing D-type, which is what triggered the whole thing in the first place. And he reckoned that he made it by there with a scrape. He reckoned he got to the end of the race with a bit of Jaguar paint on the side of the Merc. Which shows how close that was. But interesting one, I think that's because that was the one race where he was actually sharing the 300 SLR with Stirling Moss. Normally they're in separate cars, and so he's put them in the same one. And I'm pretty convinced that the two of them would have won that race probably quite comfortably
Yeah, they were well in the lead. They were leading by about two laps, I think, certainly more than a lap, when the plug was pulled by Mercedes from Stuttgart at about 2 o'clock on Sunday morning, and they'd seen off the Jaguar. In fact, when it was the other way around, when Mike Hawthorn came into the pits and triggered the accident, he had pulled away from Fangio. Fangio was some distance back, whereas earlier on in that battle, they'd been running nose to tail or side by side, and Fangio had come through, because in those days, the start was, the cars were lined up for the Le Mans run and jump start, with the biggest engine car first in the line, not based on qualifying times, based on size of engine. And so the Mercedes is only a 3-litre engine, was quite a lot. What was his number, 19 or something in the race? He was some way down the line of cars. So he had quite a bit of ground to make up to catch Hawthorn in the first place. And the other mystery, which I don't think has ever been satisfactorily explained, I don't think Stirling Moss knew the answer to this, is why, for once, did Fangio start the race rather than Stirling Moss or his co-driver or Fangio's other co-driver start the race? And it was also allegedly the race in which he got the gear lever up his trouser leg when he jumped into the car after running and jumping into it. So that delayed him further. So he had a lot of ground to make up to catch Hawthorn. But when the pit stop came, and this is one of the reasons I think why Hawthorn cut across in front of Macklin, Hawthorn had actually seen Fangio off to an extent.
Yeah, but it was a handful of seconds, wasn't it? I think that if you say that Fangio and Hawthorn were sort of a much of a muchness on that day, perhaps a slight edge to Hawthorn, I think you would have to say, with all due respect to Ivor Boehm, who was Hawthorn's co-driver, yeah, he would not have, and then wasn't able to hold on to Moss when Fangio saw it him. And you'd also probably at that time say he was a bit, not the Jaguar, well, Jaguar was a well-run team as well, of course, but I don't think they'd been able to take any time out of Mercedes in the pits either. So providing the 300 SLR had been reliable, and I did speak to Stirling about this a few years ago, and he said, you know, never broke underneath him. As far as he was concerned, it was unburstable. He was pretty convinced that they'd have won the race, and it's hard to disagree with that, really. I think they probably would have done. And I say that as someone who appreciates the Jaguar D-Type as also being a fantastic sports car. So, but yes, that probably would be a candidate for one of Fangio's great sports car drives, but sadly didn't end the way that anyone would have wanted.
Absolutely. What about throwing the 1954 German Grand Prix into the mix purely for the sort of emotional factor, as we touched on earlier in Fangio's own words? The race was overshadowed by the death of his friend Murray Moore in a practice crash. But Fangio was able to persevere and triumph despite the horror and the hardship that he suffered there. So what do we think of that drive?
Well, yeah, Murray Moore, as Kevin mentioned earlier, was Fangio's protege. He looked after him, and it was a big emotional problem for him when Marion was killed in practice, and for Gonzalez, who I think was a bit of a... I think Fangio had there was a steely aspect to his temperament. I mean, he was very much a driver who, in his day had a very strong temperament which would cope with these things in a way that a gentler soul like Gonzalez perhaps couldn't. And he, although Gonzalez also started the race, he handed over to Mike Hawthorn partway through it. Because of that, the emotional overlay, it is an outstanding drive. But of course, it's everything like that on that circuit is put into perspective by what he did a couple of 3 years later.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it's one of those sort of emotion. I think he was steely, and I don't think it was a weekend that he enjoyed at all. But he did the job. I think that day Mercedes had an edge over the opposition, and his teammates, were Hermann Lang, who was long past his best. Sadly, I think some of his best years were lost to the Second World War, and Carl Kling, who was really normally wouldn't be considered a threat to Fangio too much. And Hans Hermann as well. Yeah, I forgot there were four. I was just looking that up. There were four Mercs in that race. So I think that you would expect him to win that race anyway. He won the 56 German Grand Prix for Lazio Ferrari as well. But I think that any win there is probably worthy of being talked about. But I think the fact that the 57 race overshadows all else kind of makes it, it does elevate it above even the 54 event.
Absolutely. Well, I think, guys, we should bring this podcast to a close on that note. Now, we've sort of arrived at the moment where normally Kev and I, when we've done these in the past, it is this sort of almost descended into a moment where I have to pick me, who am I to judge, obviously, with all these great drivers, whether I would agree with their own choice for the race of my life. And I can say immediately, of course, I'm not going to do that for Juan Manuel Fangio. I certainly couldn't overrule him if this is his pick for a race of my life, which would be the 1957 German Grand Prix. And what a race it was. And I think we've covered it in great detail. It's fascinating to hear all the stories, all you guys' thoughts on that race and all the other races from Fangio's career. So thank you very much, Ian, and to Kev for joining me today. And thank you very much to you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Do let us know what you thought of it. Get in touch on social media using our handle @Autosport. And of course, check out the Race of My Life feature where you can read all of Fangio's words on autosport.com. Thank you very much.